Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
Sedano with you here. Mama Momo hanging out today on a Wednesday, presented by Progressive Insurance. Stephen A's on the line. Stephen A. Smith, check out First Take each and every morning at 7 o'clock on ESPN television. Of course, he had his ABC special, SportsCenter special, yesterday on The Last Dance. Stephen A., there are a number of things I want to talk to you about that special that I watched last night, but I don't know if you heard what Ramona and I were talking about. My suggestion was, with this campus bubble atmosphere that the NBA is talking about, that my thing is this. Instead of jumping right in there and playing games, whether it's regular season games or playoffs or whatnot, why not do at least the last 2 weeks of every team's training camp in this same bubble environment to mitigate the positive tests affecting games? So if you get there 2 weeks before the games start to finish your training camp, if guys test positive, there's less of a chance of them actually missing real games. What do you make of that?
I don't have a problem with that. I think that's certainly reasonable. I think that right now people are game started and they're thinking about what they can make money off of because of the amount of money lost already. If you're having training camp, guys are getting back to work and you understand that. But if you're having training camp or training camp type atmosphere and the actual games are not being played, that's not going to generate revenue for you. And when you've lost hundreds of millions of dollars, when the sports industry has lost in excess of $12 billion, regardless of how unpopular it is, the people to know that, although they won't engage in verbalizing that mentality, it's all about the money right now. It's all about restarting the economy and stirring up your economic situation so you can address some of the things that you need to address so you can stop losing all the money that you've been losing. That's really what their priority, where their priorities lie. And that's the only thing that makes any sense as it pertains to being averse to what you suggested.
Stephen, you know, one of the questions I keep having when I talk to people is, how much are players aware and how much do they care how much the owners are losing, right? How much the leagues are losing? Because like right now, the first paycheck where players kind of took a haircut was this last one here. It was a 25% pay cut. You know, people us at ESPN had to do that. Like we all had to make our own, you know, our own peace with all that or our own feeling about all that. Mm-hmm. They always say whenever you get, when it starts coming out of your pocket, that's when you feel it. Right? When it's coming out of somebody else's pocket, you might feel bad for them. But when it comes out of your pocket, you might feel it. How much do players either feel it themselves or care about what's going on in the league and what's coming out of the owner's pockets?
Well, first of all, make no mistake, the players feel their 25% loss, those that have suffered it. Some guys were paid their salaries in totality up front. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to take a hit until training camp opens and their new salary for the 2020-21 season kicks in. But, you know, for the most part, you got a lot of players out there. They're going to feel that pinch, make no mistake about it. Do they care about the owners losing money? Hell no, they don't. Their mentality is that, number one, they're billionaires. Number two, they're white. Number three, they never really think about us. So why the hell should we think about them? They're not going to verbalize that, obviously, because it's kind of productive to what they're trying to accomplish and establish for themselves. But make no mistake about it, that's how they feel. In the end, here's what it comes down to. The smart ones, the ones that really, really, and that's not to say anybody's dumb, but the real smart ones in terms of the ones who pay attention to both sides, the Chris Pauls, the LeBron James of the world, mm-hmm. and various others, they're going to pay attention to the owners because they know there's another collective bargaining negotiation coming up next year. And as a result of that reality, whatever pinch the owners feel, the owners have a way of making sure you feel a pinch too. If not now, definitely later. And that's why Jared Dudley came out with the tweet that he came out with approximately 2 weeks ago or so, when he sat up there and said, open our eyes, people. We don't get back to work. The owners lose that much more money. They lose that much more money. What do you think they're going to do once CBA negotiations open up for us again? They're definitely going to make sure that they address it and they're going to get something back because, you know, they took such losses now. That's the kind of mentality the smart guys have. And as a result, that also assists in the level of urgency that they have towards playing. They want to play, of course. They miss playing. They miss competing. But in reality, they also know that the more of a pinch these owners feel now, they're going to make sure those players feel it later.
Mm. Stephen A. Smith joining us here. Stephen A., as far as that's concerned, do you believe, though, that we will have radical changes to what the salary structure looks like, whether it's no luxury tax, perhaps, whether it's, you know, an amnesty situation? I know that was thrown out there this weekend as well, about where you could amnesty guys, because that way you could create room within the salary cap to add guys. It could also put players like Blake Griffin, hell, maybe even Chris Paul, potentially on the free agent market, which wouldn't have been the case heading into next offseason anyway. Like, what are some of the things that you would like to see heading into the following offseason?
Well, first of all, I think the biggest thing that, listen, nobody has a definitive answer to that question. What I will tell you is that, you know, when you talk about drastic changes or anything like that, it's all contingent on the amount of losses the owners have suffered from. Mm-hmm. And not only that, what they're projecting the losses will continue to be, because just because they get to come back doesn't mean they're still suffering from losses. You have to remember that we're anticipating they're going to come and have to play without fans in attendance. There's a certain amount of loss that they're going to have to stomach because of that. I've had a couple of owners tell me, excuse me, if we can't have fans in attendance, we might as well relocate, because we simply can't afford the upkeep. We can't afford what we're going to have to deal with without being able to rely upon fan support and fan participation, because it's that pivotal to our financial success. I would tell you, in terms of drastic changes, I think the one drastic thing, and I'm just speculating here, but I think the one drastic change that we will see is when the season actually starts. I do not believe that the season will start in mid to late October. I think that the next season that we have, the 2020-21 season, I think that's going to start in December, and it's going to go into August. That's what I believe is going to happen as of next season. That's just me being speculative based on the amount of people. I mean, Ramona speaks to everybody, and I'm sure she's heard the same thing. But you got a lot of people that are strongly, strongly entertaining that notion, which was first broached by the owner for the Atlanta Hawks long before coronavirus pandemic ever took hold. So I'm looking at that as a strong possibility, but that's the only thing that's drastic. Outside of that, I think they'll look at the books, and they'll determine what kind of losses they have suffered from. They'll project what kind of losses they'll continue to suffer from. And based off of that, they'll try to make their case to the Players Association. This is what it's costing us, so this is what it needs to cost you. And that's where the negotiations will come into play.
Mm. Oh, man, 2020. Let's go back to 1998. You want to do that? Because I've been having fun living in 98. Like, I feel like I peek my head out into 2020, and then I'm like, wait, maybe I could just go back to 98 for a little while. And right. Like your SportsCenter special last night, that was just, it was perfect, right? Like, can we do another one? I don't know, next week or something, and just like extend this along.
I doubt it.
I mean, why not? I know you worked hard to book all those guests to do all this show. Like it's amazing to me how long this news cycle has gone on The Last Dance, right? Like yesterday you had Shaq saying stuff, you had Horace Grant beefing with Michael Jordan, like he's still upset about everything. Like it's going to continue. Like, you know, they always say don't make a second day story. We're making like a 5-week story. It's amazing.
Well, listen, we love revisiting it because in fairness to ESPN, Netflix, Michael Jordan and everybody in between, the 10-part series wasn't about the 1997-98 season. It was about the Jordan era. Let's just call it what it is.
Uh-huh.
We saw stuff from early in his career. We saw stuff from the late 80s. We saw, you know, the runs in the 90s, the first three-peat, and then the second three-peat. And we got nuggets of stuff from all of those years. And so as a result of that, it allowed us to engage in revisionist history and to see and to fantasize about what might have been, to contemplate what will be in terms of today's generation and how comparable it'll be to the previous generation. All of that other stuff comes into play. But you know what? In the end, if we're being true and real to ourselves, as great as this has been, as many viewers as this has had, and I told Michael Jordan this because he and I spoke often about this stuff. I said, look, man, you wouldn't have this kind of audience if there was basketball being played right now. Mm-hmm. We'd be talking about playoff basketball. Sure, we'd watch it. You'd have a few million people watching it. No doubt about that. But it would not have resonated to the degree that it has. Michael Jordan, he's provided us with sports at a time we desperately needed because we're desperately lacking in it. Right now, the two biggest heroes in the sports world is Michael Jordan and Dana White because of what they gave us with UFC 249. We could slice it any way we want to, but that's what it comes down to, because when you're starving for anything, a cracker will smell like steak. It'll taste like steak to you. That's the way that it is, and that's what we're dealing with right now.
Stephen A. Smith hanging out with us here. Yeah, it's like the Eddie Murphy joke in Raw, where he says, "What is that cracker? Is that a Ritz? It could be a saltine, but it tastes like a Ritz that day."
That's correct.
Yeah, Stephen A. So let me ask you this: do you buy into the theory that Michael Jordan greenlit this project? It so happened to coincide shortly after LeBron one in Cleveland. Do you believe that influenced him, that there could have been an actual threat to the throne?
No, not to me. You know, in talking with MJ, you know, what his attitude was, they came to him and they made a presentation to him that he'd finally have an opportunity to say whatever the hell he wanted to say, unedited or edited to his liking or whatever the case may be. He would say what he felt and it was it, and that was that. And so he saw that as an opportunity to do it, and that's what he did. Obviously, he didn't discuss everything. He clearly ruffled a few feathers along the way. But in his mind, you asked him his honest opinion about something, and he gave it to you. And he was willing to give it to you because there was going to be an extensive amount of time and money dedicated to him doing just that. You know, when you have folks that have been talking about he's made so much money off of this, he's donated it all to charity. He hasn't taken a dime. He's not getting a dime from this. He did it because he wanted to do it, because the presentation that was presented to him said, your voice is going to be profoundly heard in this docuseries. Go ahead and speak your piece. And that's what he did.
You know, I think it was interesting because I talked to the producer, Mike Tolan, who made the pitch to Jordan, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a couple of things that I think that get lost in the characterization of, oh, he had the pitch on the same day that LeBron and the Cavs had their victory parade. That was a coincidence, okay? Like, and it was the same year, by the way, the Warriors broke the Bulls record, okay, of 73. They got 73 wins that year. But nobody had ever even gotten into a room with Jordan to pitch him, because Michael has Esty Portnoy and Curtis Polk around him, and they're the consiglieres, right? Like, you have to, I don't want to just call them gatekeepers because they're bigger than that, okay? But
no question.
Esty and Curtis had been working on this project for years, and nothing ever made sense to them because Esty and Curtis are the cultivators of brand Jordan, where it's as much about the brand as it is about the man now. And my understanding is they never felt like a two-hour doc or whatever documentaries, you know, were at the time, was sufficient to, like, do justice to the man and his career and the era, as you put it earlier, right? So I know Kobe actually had a meeting with him. Like, he wanted to produce The Last Dance. He knew about the footage. There, Spike Lee had a couple meetings over the years. But it never really turned until we started having these limited series, these 8-10 episode series, where now Esty and Curtis were saying, oh, okay, maybe out over 8 or 10 episodes, we could do justice to it. And so Mike Tolan, the guy who had this meeting, he's the first guy who ever made it past Esty and Curtis into the room with Michael. And I think that's probably the biggest answer to it all. And the one thing I'm wondering now, though, since you're in touch with Mike, how is he taking the backlash that's coming? How is he taking the Horace Grants of the world, Scotty, whoever else has been ruffled?
It's pissing him off
.
because he knows how much he didn't say in terms of what they have had to say. Like when it became public that Scotty was not happy, he was upset because he says Scotty saw the docuseries before it came out and had no problem with it. So he only had a problem with it after, you know, folks reacted the way that they reacted. I don't know how much truth there is to that. I did not ask Scotty that question. Scotty definitely feels it's the Jordan era. It's a documentary on the Jordan era as opposed to the 1997-98 team. He's quick to remind everybody that Jordan did not win alone, that Jordan won with teammates. Jordan's comeback is, when did I fail to give Scotty praise? Mm-hmm. I said I could not have won without him. I called him one of the greatest players to have ever played, the greatest teammate that I've ever had. I've said that repeatedly over the years. What's the problem? With the Horace Grant situation, we know what Horace Grant recently said of the last 24 hours. Jordan acknowledges that, listen, the relationship with him and Horace wasn't great. Part of the problem was in 1992, him and Scotty won gold medal for the original Dream Team. After that summer was over and they came into camp, Phil Jackson was accustomed to having two-a-days. He allowed Scotty and Michael Jordan to have only one-a-days because they had played in the summer. And Horace had a fit about that because he felt like they were being treated differently and they were being, you know, there was a double standard. And Michael was like, but we played over the summer. You didn't. So what's the problem? Mm-hmm. You know, it was stuff like that that got on his nerves. Or Craig Hodges. Craig Hodges is obviously a very Afrocentric. I love him personally in terms of, I don't know him, but as a black man, the challenges that he was willing to take, his intellect, his consciousness, I'm a fan of Craig Hodges. Make no mistake about it. But, you know, to go up to Michael Jordan reportedly and Magic Johnson on the basketball court before game one of the NBA Finals and ask them to boycott at that particular moment to bring awareness to the plight of black America. Could you imagine how disastrous that would have been if Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson would have done that at that particular moment? No plan, no anything. Just, oh, we're not going to play. You know, right before tip-off time. That's what he supposedly wanted to do. So if you're Michael Jordan, you're looking at the people who have had issues with you. You're also witnessing some of their struggles and how they might have a problem with the fact that you haven't had those struggles. I don't know whether what's true or what isn't. I do know to some degree that's how MJ is feeling right now based on their reaction, you know, to the documentary. And he was specifically perturbed. He was specifically perturbed that Horace brought up the word snitch and was talking about Michael mentioning drugs in a hotel room in the early 80s. And Michael Jordan's position is the league was a drug-infested league when David Stern took it over. Mm-hmm. Everybody and their mother knew that. I didn't mention any names, but anybody that covered the league knew what was going on. Mm. So how is it that me saying something like that that's been well-documented and well-publicized about what the state of the NBA was and what it had to become and what it had to turn into, how am I being called that when I mentioned no names? I didn't call anybody out. I simply gave a picture of the kind of climate that I walked into coming out of college. Mm. It's like, you know, so he says stuff like this, and that's the kind of stuff that's really ticked him off because he feels like it's unnecessary for people to try to reach. You know, if you want to address him on what he said and say specifically what your problem is, as opposed to trying to reach and attach something to it that he didn't say. That's where he's coming from with it. I understand it, but I also understand Horace Grant being a bit pissed off, because if somebody sat up there and said to any of us, you directly leaked information to a reporter about what was going on in our locker room, and any of us believed that we were completely innocent of such an allegation, we would be breathing hell and fury just like Horace Grant is. So I see both sides in that regard.
Stephen A., two more quick ones on the way out here. And Stephen A., make sure you check out First Take each and every morning at 7 a.m. on ESPN television. Thank you so much for giving us the time that you have here. So Shaq yesterday on your SportsCenter special on ABC was talking to you about the impact of Michael Jordan and was talking to you about LeBron and specifically Kobe. And he made the comment that he feels that Kobe should also be put in that conversation with LeBron, with Michael Jordan. How do you feel about Shaq's comments?
I don't have any problem with that. I think Kobe's one of the greatest ever. I think the problem with the Kobe stature or the Kobe cachet is that he's the perennial number two, not as in sidekick, but the perennial number two to Michael Jordan. if it were not for Michael Jordan, we would be having an open discussion every day as to whether or not Kobe Bryant was the greatest off guard in the history of basketball. The problem is that the person that comes before him is recognized as arguably the greatest that we have ever seen in the history of basketball, period, meaning at any position. Michael Jordan is the greatest player in the history of basketball in a lot of our eyes, and he played the same position as Kobe Bryant. So Kobe being number two to that guy, that's really the issue. If there were no Jordan, then we would be having a different discussion about Kobe Bryant. So his greatness cannot be denied. He was honored posthumously as well as he should be and will continue to be for years and years to come because he deserved it. He was a champion. He was a warrior. And my personal, you know, from my vantage point, he was also a friend. I love him and I miss him. And the bottom line is that for him, you know, to be recognized that way by Shaq, I think it's apropos. I think it definitely makes sense. It's just that, again, LeBron James is in the discussion as the greatest ever. Not in my mind, but 14% of the folks in the polls think that he's the greatest ever. He's clearly the greatest small forward in the history of basketball. He's certainly one of the greatest all-around players and arguably on the Mount Rushmore of basketball. So you wouldn't put Kobe there because MJ's already there. That's the problem.
Last one for you, Stephen A., and I think this may be the toughest question we will ask you today. What is a bigger thrill for you, Stephen A. Smith, having your own ABC SportsCenter special about The Last Dance and that great documentary, or being Brick, the fictional character, the recurring role on ABC's soap opera, General Hospital, one of the greatest soap operas in the history of soap operas? Which is it, Stephen A.?
If it were just the show itself, I would say Brick, because I get tickled to death every time I'm on the set with those folks at General Hospital, who are absolutely wonderful to me. They're like family, especially the star, Maurice Bernard, who plays Sonny Corinthos. That's my man. We talk every week. You know, it's phenomenal for me to be on that show. I absolutely love it, and I'm no actor, but I just love it. I get tickled to death every time I show up there. The only reason that I wouldn't put it above last night's show is because I didn't just host it. It was the first time that I executive produced one of my shows. So I was the executive producer of that last night. And that was the first time in my career that I had ever been allowed to do that. It's something that I wanted to do for a long time. It's something that I plan on doing in the future, starting my own production company that's already in the works and doing some things. I have all of those goals, those aspirations for myself. And ABC, ESPN, they gave me an opportunity to do that last night, and that was my first foray into being an executive producer. So I would have to put that above General Hospital, but only because I was the EP and not just the host.
Well, congratulations, sir. You know we love you around here. We always appreciate the time. We root for your success. We're very happy for you. And thank you so much again for hanging out with us, man. Stay safe and healthy, okay?
Love you guys. You know, I love you, Ramona. Thank you all so much. Y'all,
thanks, Stephen A. And by the way, I don't want to sell you short, man. You may not have an executive producer title on every show that you do, but I know how hard you work to produce every show you're on.
Hardest working man in sports.
All those guests don't just turn up.
First Take, I don't have the EP title on First Take, but you're absolutely right. My fingerprints are all over that show every day. So you're right about that.
All right, Stephen A., thanks again. Appreciate it. Talk soon.
Y'all take care.
All right, there he is, Stephen A. Smith.